Gettysburg Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast. Conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more. With voices from around the corner and around the globe.
Good day. Welcome to the Seminary Explorers. My guest today is Dr. Joseph Danella, who is chaplain of the college in the Office of Religion and Spiritual Life. He's also adjunct professor in religious studies at Gettysburg College. Welcome, Joseph.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Okay. You're part of what has become a tradition, the top stories in religion of the year. And so this is 2016. And so we'd like to ask you, or I'd like to ask you, some of the top stories that you found in 2016. And so I'm going to start off, what is your first topic?
Well, I don't know if there's really an order to this, except that the thing that came to my mind most immediately was the Black Lives Matter movement. And the reason I think of that as a religious topic is primarily because it has to do with some deep-seated problems in American life. The issue of how do we perceive race and racism? How do we deal with different cultures understanding the way in which people are treated by police? How do neighborhoods and communities understand the perspectives of those who come from places that they're not used to thinking about?
Well, it seems to me that this is, you know, this is a really a headline topic in 2016, but it's been a topic over the decades in the last century, and right, even before that.
Yes.
I think of Du Bois and the two consciousness, and the issue in the United States is that of race.
Sure. Well, one of the things that I just to use yesterday as an example, if I might, we did for the community here at the seminary an evening program that was sponsored, I guess, by the seminary and Citizens Against Gun Violence and the Interfaith Peace and Justice community here in Gettysburg. And one of the people who got up to speak talked about how this community, Gettysburg, is perceived as a very safe community, and people didn't understand what was going on
right
in more urban-centered contexts. And I thought, well, there's a degree to which that makes sense, except that you wonder how long it takes people to hear other people. Everyone who lives in this community didn't grow up in this community. And I recall sharing that I grew up in Chicago. Chicago right now has the highest incidence of gun violence and murder in the nation.
Right.
This year, this summer, earlier, the statistics were there were 800 murders in Chicago.
Oh, my.
And most of them, it seemed to be arbitrary incidents of gun violence, people being shot in the street, people getting angry and deciding that they were going to strike out against somebody or hurt somebody.
Right.
And that's not to even mention the people who experience violence as a result of interactions with the police, which is how the Black Lives Matter issue started. But I remember sitting there and thinking, as this person was talking, so do I sound naive when I say that I grew up with the understanding that at any given moment, violence could erupt and I could be victimized, so that I have a sort of cautious some people would say paranoia about the world around me, but
Well, particularly if you grow up in the urban areas, for me in Brooklyn, New York, it's one of those constant things that you think about.
Right.
But I think when you live in the small towns, you become oblivious. You try to become oblivious, and yet you can see from the newspaper accounts that the same things happen.
Oh, sure.
In small places.
Well, and I guess that's what was striking to me, because there was sort of this attitude of this never happens here, or it could never happen here, and yet even the person who was speaking says, "Well, it could happen here."
Right.
And there are enough cultural misunderstandings that there's probably going to be a day when it does happen here. And how will we help people to understand? Well, the beginning of the Black Lives Matter movement, when the people came to the college to speak, we kept hearing the "All lives matter," and of course all lives matter. But as was said over and over again, the reason for saying Black Lives Matter is because Black lives were forgotten. They've been the people who've been overlooked in political discourse and national discourse. How could this happen? And as you mentioned earlier, people were, this has been going on. This didn't just start happening in 2016. This has been going on for decades, the history of this country, if you will.
Right. Have you thought about how might we change this pattern?
Okay.
Any ideas on that?
Well, the first thing for me, and I guess what captured me, is we have to open ourselves up and hear and listen to communities that sometimes feel under siege. And then we must ask the next question of, so what do we do? Hmm. How do we change this behavior? How do we stop the kind of heightened sense of fear that says that somehow, in many instances, a black male is more threatening and foreboding than someone in a white community who's perceived as a part of the community, and even though they might be engaged in the same kind of behavior as a black young person,
right,
somehow they're not a threat, while a black person doing that is perceived as threatening. How do we change that? How do we change the attitudes? How do we get people to recognize the essential humanity of everyone, regardless as to what they look like or what they believe or where they come from? I think that's the perhaps the essential religious question.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Going on to topic number two, I think you identified as a need for immigration reform. I know during the election we heard a lot about immigration, but what is your thoughts on that?
Well, again, as I look and I've responded and I've heard what's going on, the first thing that struck me this year was we were hearing about the need for relief for immigrants from Syria, from war-torn captivity.
Yes.
And the political discourse in this country became to be kind, zany. People of Islamic backgrounds were somehow now targeted as potential terrorists. We've done that sort of thing in the past in this country, but it makes absolutely no sense, especially when our claim is that we welcome people seeking liberty, seeking freedom.
Right.
The Islamic people that I know are not even close to being people that you need to be frightened of. They want the same essential human conditions. They love their families. They love the communities they're a part of. They seek to contribute to the society. And yes, they may approach that with some religious and cultural difference in the background, but that's no reason to close off borders. But it's not just the Islamic community. Growing up in Chicago, Chicago's a fascinating city. Every immigrant group in the country is right there. And when I was a kid, I just could not imagine what it would have been like to say to people of Hispanic background, you're not welcome here. The contributions that were made to my own life, to the city in general, by people who came from Mexico or Puerto Rico or Latin America,
right,
were just astounding. And the idea that we need to shut off this group of people from a welcome in this country, it makes no sense to me, especially when we look at the overall patterns of migration and the history. We forget that most of Southwest America was the United States of Mexico, not the United States of North America.
And right,
that in land grab efforts, we claim territory by war and by all sorts of practices that were certainly
we'd frown on now,
yes,
if we did, right?
Yes. So, when you visit the so-called Mexican border these days, then as you start hearing the history of the patterns of migration, you end up asking the question, who crossed whose border?
Mm.
And so, for thousands, not hundreds, not decades, for thousands and thousands of years, the migratory pattern in the Southwest was, during the winter, you went south and deeper towards the equator, and in the summer, you went north, where it would be cooler, and where you could take advantage of the open and arid land. And now we think, we claim that territory is ours. Those people who have inherited these patterns don't have the right to make such crosses.
Right, and we have thousands, millions of immigrants,
yes,
over the years, and who have made contributions, mm-hmm, to what it is. It might be defined as American culture.
Yes,
there's an integration that takes place,
mm-hmm,
that we aren't aware of, in terms of foods that we eat.
Mm-hmm.
I remember as a student in the Gettysburg area,
mm-hmm,
I didn't see foods from the Central America or the Caribbean area. That was,
sure,
40 years ago,
mm-hmm,
and that's changed now. You go into the grocery store, you see plantain and other things that you would not.
Oh, no, sure. Yeah.
So you talk about this pattern, and it's here,
mm-hmm,
and we have to be used to it.
It also is true, at least for me, that I don't know how we read our Hebrew scriptures, our mm-hmm, Christian scriptures, and omit the passages that say, welcome the stranger.
Yes.
When you read the Hebrew scriptures, what's the reason given for actually the Exodus experience and interpretation of the commandments? You were freed from bondage and slavery in Egypt. Remember how the Lord your God freed you. Remember that you were a stranger and alien in Egypt. Mm-hmm. Treat the stranger and the alien in your midst with kindness and with compassion. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's an essential part of the tradition.
Right, exactly.
And
Yeah, and we need to reclaim that and remember that.
Yes.
For ourselves. Yes. Okay. Topic number three. Political and interfaith dialogue. What do you mean by that for our listening audience?
Oh gosh, this one is near and dear to my heart. I have for at least the last decade and a half at the college tried to foster a sense of the oneness that we share as people of faith, and to get people to know each other better, to be able to do things in common together, such as pray for large community events, for baccalaureate, for commencement at different times of the year. And one of the things that I heard in the climate was, well, people don't understand this. People aren't really all that excited about this. We should look and claim the distinctiveness of our own religious traditions without trying to, if you will, understand that of the others, or even worship and pray together, because our young people don't know their own traditions. Mm-hmm. And so how can you dialogue about traditions and shared values when you don't know your own faith?
Right, yeah, I could hear people saying that.
Yes. And
how do you respond to that?
My response is that you actually learn the value of your tradition in dialogue with other people, that it never becomes as clear to you what the uniqueness of your own perspective is until you hear it contrasted with someone else's. And even in contrast with someone else's, it can be surprising what you share in common. It can be surprising to hear that the common thread between Judaism and Christianity and Islam is actually compassion. Hmm. It's actually that God is merciful. It's actually that we pray and give thanks to God for the blessings that God bestows on us. It's not we have the right way and you have the wrong way. It's really, and when you think about the fact that these three traditions, at least, share an Abrahamic tradition
together. That's true.
It's that we are related to each other, that we are sisters and brothers in a deeper sense than perhaps you can find in any other place. Now, that doesn't mean that the world's great religious traditions are limited to Christianity or Judaism or Islam. There's also the great traditions of the East, of Buddhism,
right,
and Confucianism, and Sikhs, and Jains, and Hindus, and even underlying those traditions is a deep sense of the eternal presence of the divine that you commune with, that you come in contact with, and that somehow, if it's infused in you, will show you how to treat other people.
Mm. And I guess unless we have that dialogue, we omit or forget, mm-hmm, or dismiss the other.
Well, because it's difficult doesn't mean it shouldn't be done.
Mm-hmm.
And in institutions of higher education, that's the one place I see where it's absolutely essential that it be done. We don't ignore it. We don't stop teaching calculus and nuclear physics and all the scientific apparatus that we need in our contemporary world because we say, oh, those sciences are difficult, yeah, and the average person is not capable of understanding them. No, we teach them.
Okay,
and then we go on.
Right, and yeah. And hopefully in the next year we will continue to, mm-hmm, to learn to listen.
Yes.
To the other.
Yes.
To the other. Our fourth topic you have is the next few has to do with Pope Francis, and I'm dividing them. And the first of interest, topic number four, is visit to synagogue and the mosques in Rome.
Well, I mean, that in some ways is related to what we were just talking
about. That's right.
If you think about it. Pope Francis, I find to be a wonderful person as leader of the Western Catholic tradition. And one of the things I marvel at is he's not apologetic in the sense of a sort of denying his role as a teaching authority for the Western Church. But he does offer apologies for attitudes and mistakes in the past that we all sort of recognize and grapple with. And what I saw in this visit to the synagogue in Jerusalem and in the mosque is an attempt not only at saying, please forgive the treatment and the bad attitudes of the past, let's do something to change that. Let's begin to see how together we might explore a different future. And that's a very different attitude than the kind of retrenchment of, our position is rock solid, and you either become what we are, or
to me, this visit indicates an openness to the other, an openness to one's fellow human being.
Sure.
You know, in terms of the leaders in these two religious groups, so that does change, helps to change an attitude.
Yes,
helps change an attitude. Number five. In terms of interest, you have the Vatican II and its declaration of the Church in the modern world. Say something about, well, one, Vatican II, because I think many in our listening audience might not have been born during Vatican II.
I forget that sometimes. I guess it is true. Yeah. Vatican II has been subject to such radical interpretation in a sense, some reframing, some saying in a sense that it was a mistake and that now what we have experienced more recently is a kind of return to an old world understanding of Catholicism. But Vatican II did some really significant things, and this Church in the modern world and Nostra Aetate, some of the other encyclicals, do some things with the Christian community that are just marvelous. One, Rome declares that the other Christian communities are indeed sister churches. And that they are validly, although they do offer sort of a tongue-in-cheek caveat that, you know, they're not fully expressions of the Church, but they are expressions of the Church and should be recognized. And I think that is something that's worth underscoring. But there's also something that comes out, not in Nostra Aetate, but in the Vatican's approach to other world religions, where in Vatican II it says God is present fully and completely in the other world's religious tradition.
Now that is definitely a radical view, or
a stark demarcation
from before, or the attitude from before.
Now, one of my teachers, and I may have talked with you about this before, a Holy Ghost father who is a missionary to the Maasai tribe in Africa, Vince Donovan. I remember sitting in his office and talking with him about the church's attitude towards missiology. And Vince said, when I went to the Maasai, the attitude of the church was that we were bringing the gospel to the Maasai. After living with the Messiah for 25 years, I realized that we weren't bringing the gospel to the Messiah. The Messiah already had the gospel. God was already there. All we were doing was trying to figure out how, in fact, the God that they already knew could be expressed in the context of a Christian worldview.
Oh, that's a powerful, yeah. Powerful statement.
So,
powerful statement.
You know, the understanding that God is present in the world, in world religions, in people, which was a really vital and significant part of the Second Vatican Council. I think this Pope embodies in his interactions with people more fully than his predecessors did.
Right. It seems like, you know, he's. I think of Pope John the 23rd.
Yes.
And then I skip to Pope Francis, you know, sort of. So much has happened in between, but he seems to carry the voice and the words of Vatican II.
Yes.
And that's very helpful, will be very helpful to us.
Yeah.
Your sixth item, reflection, has to do with, again, Pope Francis.
Indeed.
But this time with Lutherans and his visit to Sweden and the Lutheran World Federation.
Mm-hmm. There have been some sort of interesting trickles. Francis declared that he was going to go to Sweden, that he was going to participate in a visit and prayer service with Lutherans to commemorate the start of the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. He also asked the question, again, can something be done to move our communities towards fuller communion and fuller dialogue? One of the things that I remember, you know, and it's been a long time since I was a college student now, but
I'll make no comment.
but I remember as a college student that one of the things, and this was back in the early 70s, one of the things that was significant that came out of the Second Vatican Council was that the condemnations of Luther had been retracted.
Right. That's right.
We still have people in both of our communities acting as if those condemnations still are in effect. And consequently, some of the attitudes is that if you're a Lutheran, you're supposed to hate Roman Catholics. If you're a Catholic, you're supposed to hate Lutherans. It makes no sense. It actually makes no sense whatsoever. So to hear Francis say, I'm going to go, I'm going to pray, I'm going to participate in this commemoration of the Reformation, in some ways is an implicit acknowledgement that the Reformation was necessary, and that there were, as the statements that have arisen, there were mistakes made on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
There was truth on both sides. I love the fact that we were present for that joint signing on Declaration by Grace Through Faith.
Right.
Where, in fact, the statement was made that the two churches no longer needed to condemn each other's essential teaching, but recognize that they were perhaps opposite sides of the same coin, that they were articulating essential aspects of the gospel in different ways, but that at root, their understanding of the gospel was a shared and common understanding. You know, that's hopeful. That says that I don't have to base my religious perspective on antagonism towards someone who expresses that differently,
right,
or understands that differently. And
very helpful.
Yeah.
It's very helpful to us.
Mm-hmm.
And the seventh the seventh item in terms of 2016, again, has to do with Pope Francis.
Okay.
And this has to do with his apology to other Christian communities.
Yes. Well, it just simply, again, was a statement of the Roman Catholic Church in regards to other Christian communities has made statements, done things, and in fact even supported warfare in the name of religion, and that the inability of the church to recognize the fullness of Christ in other Christian communities is wrongheaded. Again, to me, it's hopeful. It says, yes, it's possible to be fully a church, fully an embodiment of the presence of Christ, and to be related to Rome without having to necessarily be Roman.
Well, on that note, I agree we've completed the top stories for you in religion for 2016, and each of these, at least from my perspective, you end on hope, and as we enter and begin 2017.
Well, I think right now the only thing we can do is hope.
Indeed.
The one thing that I've been thinking about a lot in the last month or so is there's a lot to despair about in North America. I am hopeful that we can change things for the future. I'm worried about the denial of essential religious values that have underscore the behavior of the nation as it's engaged in its political sphere and as it looks to the future. My hope is that we don't do the things that were promised as part of the presidential election. They, to me, would be not only anti-Christian, they're anti-religious and anti-human.
On that note, then, we look in hope, and to be in hope for ourselves, individuals, as well as our nation and our world for 2017. My guest today has been Dr. Joseph Danella, who is a chaplain of the college and adjunct professor in the Religious Studies Department at Gettysburg College. For the Seminary Explorers, Nelson Strobert, have a good day.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explorers, from historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, a production of Gettysburg Seminary. We invite you to visit our website at www.ltsg.edu. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of Gettysburg Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.